when I went to weapons school and taught there, not only did I go there as a student, they asked me back to teach, just like, you know, whatever.
So the Top Gun, you went back to teach.
Weapons school. So I went back to teach and learned even more about teaching, because you couldn't screw up against the best guys coming in.
Welcome to Kung Fu Podcast, where we explore the culture, the adventure, and the impact of martial arts. And I'm your host, T.W. Smith. If this is your first time to the program, welcome. You're in the audience of some of the finest and sharpest martial artists in the world, people that put in a great deal of care and a great deal of sweat to honing the craft. What you just heard was an F-15 Eagle flyby. The 200th episode of Kung Fu Podcast is in honor of what the name stands for, the pursuit of excellence. The work it takes to achieve a sense of mastery of literally anything, in particular in martial arts, is a dedicated multi-year practice. Being an instructor of some of the very best requires another entire level of work. In this episode, we're going to take a get-to-know-you walk with Lieutenant Colonel, retired Air Force fighter pilot, Mark Weiser. We got to meet through a mutual friend, someone who has been a friend of mine for 25 years, and someone that Mark and I have a huge respect for, former U.S. Marine, John Cleary. Mark and I sat down recently, along with his daughter Hannah, to get introduced and discuss the values and the experiences that he has that makes him one of the most elite F-15 fighters in the world. And he is going to bring it for us. I'm a firm believer that if you want to get better at anything that you do, look at what drives and the experiences gained through other people as they pursue excellence in their field. You are nearly 100% assured that you're going to find some takeaways. So if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's get into the cockpit of what life has brought Mark Weiser. This is Mark Weiser, a retired U.S. Air Force fighter pilot, and we got together through a mutual good friend, John Cleary, who I think both Mark and I could both say is the sort of guy who is about as steady as a rock as years go through, somebody who I've always looked up to and for almost, I guess, a little over 25 years now. He put me together with Mark, and so Mark, tell the audience and me, actually, because I don't know, and it's part of the reason why I wanted to keep this organic, because I'm going to learn as we go. How long were you in the Air Force? What was your rank, and what did you do?
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. I've been in the Air Force formally over 20 years. You count the Air Force Academy, that's almost 25. So most of my life was in the Air Force and retired about 10 years ago. I met John in high school. He's a year ahead of me. Always looked up to him, even though he's a little shorter. So to see him again was super. I went right out of the high school to the Air Force Academy to the service, entering with a short time off, like a month or so, and then academy to pilot training, and then got picked up to fly. I got in it very naive. And it just drove me for the next 20 years.
All right. So just out of curiosity for me, what as a pilot, what were you flying at that time? And what are we talking about 1987 or so?
1987, that's a good question. It's, you don't just jump into a fighter. There's a lot of screening going on between the beginning of your flying experience and trying to generate a pilot.
Okay.
I'm not talking civilian, we're talking about the Air Force at the time, because things have changed. But
sure.
My first flying was probably in 87, late 87, in gliders.
Gliders?
So they had a program to, the first thing you do is you're going to learn how to fly gliders.
All right, so in martial arts, we would call this is your white belt, yellow belt training, right?
Except the airplane was yellow. It was pink and yellow.
Pink and yellow?
No, just painted yellow.
Oh, painted yellow.
And it was really neat. I mean, and the people who taught it were the older cadets. So there's four years of cadets. That's when the leadership upgrades, I guess, during the, if you call it that, during the academy. And cadets would teach cadets with the supervision of officers to make sure everything was safe.
Okay.
So 17 years old, I'm flying the glider, and I had a hoot. And it was very neat, you know.
In the martial arts, one of the things I love to have as far as my students go, for example, it's one thing to learn something and to feel like you kind of got it embraced. It's another thing to take it and then to have to teach it and deal with other people's questions and concerns or whatever else.
Yeah, that's almost true. There was, for them to be an instructor, they would have to go through another program. Hmm. So you learn the basic. I walked away knowing how to fly a glider. Some guys got picked or asked to get into the program to be an instructor. So they would go through a formal instructor course with the officers to teach them how to teach. You never stop learning how to teach. And that was the magic of my career, I think, is I kept on learning better ways to teach.
Okay.
Some people go through and they just fly the glider, you know, metaphorically speaking. Hmm. But I got put in positions to teach and teach and teach to different levels throughout my career. Probably one of my strong points. But after the glider thing, these guys got to teach. You know, it's very fulfilling. And then they learn other, and then we move on to other things. Like the next part of the program is a single engine Cessna. We called it the T-41 because the Air Force has to put a T or something on it.
Hmm.
But we flew that to learn how to fly single engine airplanes, and that one ended in solo, and you're checked out on a Cessna. All right, and if you could, and not everybody passes that. Hmm. Almost everybody gets through the gliders, almost everybody gets to the T-41s. And then you're done with the flying at the academy, and there are plenty of other things to keep our time filled.
Hmm.
But then you graduate, a real degree, a very difficult place to go to school. It wasn't a college experience like some have had. It was a military academy.
Hmm.
So when we left there, it was great. I mean, to leave there with it in the rearview mirror is kind of the joke, but it's a very fulfilling feeling. You got out of the Air Force Academy. And you know your assignment. At the time, if you're a pilot qualified, they would try to get you to, they will get you in the pilot training. So if you pass that, you become a pilot, because that's what we do. You know, for us, as opposed to the Marines or the Army, the fighters are really the officers, and the core of the pilot training cadre comes out of the Air Force Academy. So I got to do that. At the time, as I was going through pilot training, we started with T-37s, a small jet, twin-engine jet, and we moved on from there to T-38s, which was a supersonic tandem seating jet. Both great airplanes. They've been around for God knows how long.
So at this phase of your training, about how many have kind of disappeared? You know, I'm assuming that, you know, this process has not just a flying aspect. It's probably got character aspects, how you conduct yourself, and scholastic components of it, you know, learning and things like that. I mean, or was it just strictly the skill set of learning to fly?
No, well, learning to fly, there's a lot of knowledge. It's very knowledge-based. Everything from basic aerodynamics to the systems of the aircraft to how to navigate. Everybody has a dream of getting to a cockpit once you've been flying for a little bit, and you sit down and all the gauges are different and you have no idea. You even know how to start the thing. So it's not like getting in, put the keys on, let's go. I can go on for how stupid you feel during the time of the training, because if anybody felt stupid, it was me.
You know, see, but that's an excellent point. As we were talking about before all this started, you know, a lot of times in martial arts, you'll see somebody do something, or you'll be given an instruction, and you would think you should already know it. And to feel that way will keep you from asking questions that perhaps you should ask before you try to keep driving forward. Do you already have some ideas about exactly what your mission is going to be when you get in there?
Well, if we're going to go with, I was describing pilot training.
Oh, okay.
Getting into the fighter business, there is rarely a time, I can't actually have to really think about the time we just go out and our objective of the day is to go have fun. And the only time we would do that is if someone got rewarded to sit in my back seat and we go out, and it would be like a maintenance fellow that worked on the airplanes, or a fuels guy that, you know, was the best fuels guy on base for the year. And they would, that was an incentive, we call it an incentive program, for guys to get in back. And I would take him up, instead of normally with the Wizzo, I have a two-seat aircraft, and I would go out and give them the thrill of their lives. It's overpowering and almost indescribable if you've never done it, to really give you the smell, taste, and feel of what it takes to, what it feels like to just take off.
Wow. I mean,
just to have the afterburner kick off for starters. To have the engine start is scary as anything in the backseat. I mean, just because it is loud. It's angry. It's a hunk of metal with a whole bunch of moving parts, you know.
Mm.
But every other day, when I briefed or led a mission, and I say this in a context, I was a high timer. There are not many people that have flown more than I have in that aircraft.
Which aircraft are you referring to now?
Oh, my bad. My apologies. The F-15E model is a two-seat fighter aircraft that has replaced or took the place of in development of other aircraft. So the objective of this airplane initially was to be able to self-support itself into bad guy territory and drop bombs at the same time. Not exactly before, but in the development of fighter aircraft over time, they usually had a single purpose. Like either you're going to shoot other airplanes, you're going to drop bombs, and that's generically speaking. So fighters took on specific roles when a lot of money was coming through with the Cold War and we had to combat, you know, X, Y, and Z. Here's our plan. We're going to need this, so we're going to build this airplane for that purpose. That's gone away, and the price of aircraft had gotten so big, they have to now, if we're going to buy it, has to have a multi-role capability.
Okay.
So the last one that I could think of, off the top of my head, is the F-117 Nighthawk was defined for a simple purpose of going through radars unseen and dropping a few bombs and coming home. They called it a fighter, but really it was a hide as best you can bomb dropper.
Okay.
You know? My aircraft is about the most important aircraft, in my opinion, that we've had over the period of my lifespan. It can basically do anything. It is bigger than the rest. It carries more gas than the rest. It can hang around a lot more. It carries more bombs and carries more missiles. So over all the things we've had to do since I got in, remember I got in, that was Desert Storm 1, and between there and here, we've been in conflict the whole time. I mean, I've been deployed, I can't tell you how many times, over her lifetime, you know. I got sent back one time early for a deployment because of her getting ready to come on out.
So, it's for the audience, Mark is referring to, Hannah, do you want to say hey to the audience?
Hi.
There you go. So, one of the things I read about was that the F-15 was pretty much one of the most elite pieces of equipment or weapons. It's been in a lot of conflicts, and it's not just, I didn't realize it's not just a U.S. weapon. Is it something that they sell to other countries as well?
Well, like I said, I flew the E model. The A through D models, actually, it's a fun story.
Okay, thank you.
Here's the U.S. big guys sitting around, and all of a sudden, they go to an air show, and our guys look up, and they see this monster airplane. It turns out we term it or label it the MiG-25. The Soviets back then just showed up at this air show with this monster airplane that was killer. I mean, he was a bad, one bad Johnny is what we used to call him.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't have anything like it. We just went, ooh. So they came back and went, there's a one bad Johnny over there at the Soviets. And they went, well, we need a bad Johnny. So they developed it in record time from concept to first flight and something silly, like somewhere between 18 and 24 months. That's totally off of memory, but it was quick enough where they went, we found something here. So that was the A model. The B model was a two-seat version on there, so you could train people to fly the A model, and it's a single-seat aircraft. So we fight single seat in this thing, and their mission was to shoot down other aircraft.
Okay.
The C model came as an upgrade to it years later to go, hey, we need to upgrade this thing. And then other airplanes were getting too old. I mean, they just have a service life, just like a car. And they went, you know, we got to get something else up there. We can't. How about we take this cool 15 that has been doing fantastic and slap some bombs on it, some bomb racks on it, and let's see how it works. And through some concept development, it wasn't a hard transition, but they developed the F-15E model. They made it a two-seat version, copied from an old F-4. And F-4 was air-to-ground, air-to-air workhorse force for years and years and years. So that was the concept. The same company owned it, McDonnell Douglas, and they made this, and boom, Bud's got a new airplane.
So when you go through a piece of equipment change, or that the whole objective of your weapon, and then that's collaterally going to mean that your missions are now going to change, because now, as you were explaining, you're a fighter pilot, and now all of a sudden you're also a bombardier. This was something that evolved during your tenure as a pilot, correct?
Well, when I talk about flying, I promise you I'm going to do it again. I'm going to refer to me as Bud. And I refer to myself as a third person, in third person, while I tell flying stories. It's just in my instructor brain. I can't get rid of it.
And
it's my call sign.
Okay. Thank you, Hannah.
I didn't catch it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Bud is my call sign.
It was. You wore it on your patches. I had it your name
on mine. It's my soul. Mm-hmm. But everybody calls me Bud.
Okay. Bud.
And Bud works. But when Bud was young, when Bud was a learning how to fly guy, that's when the airplane came out. When I got in the airplane, it was almost still with a new car set. We were still picking them up from the assembly line. Mm. And there's only so many of them. But anyway, they developed it. We got them in the field. And then Bud went to pilot training, and Bud got a 15E. I didn't know anything what an objective was. All I knew is I had to fly this jet to learn something today in this training or aircraft. When it comes to actual objectives in a fighter aircraft, I was completely clueless. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But that's where I learned objectives. So generically speaking, from the first time I learned how to fly this airplane, we had a whole bunch of simulators, academics. I can't stress enough how much academics were a part of my life. Academics, learning, fly. Learn, fly. Hmm. The program to learn how to fly from a trainer to a fighter, you don't just get in a fighter and say, go fight. You have to learn how to fight and then try it.
So when you were saying Bud in his time, was getting used to doing things and learning and flying, learn, fly. Were there any time during that process that you doubted yourself, that perhaps you said, maybe I'm over my head here? What were your feelings during that time? Because I'm assuming that getting to where you were, if 100 men tried to make it, we're probably down to like 2 or 3.
I'm saying this knowing, with some bit of humility, on how fortunate I have been. I believe that fortune comes through work. So the opportunities come through work. The fact that I got into this airplane at that time was a statistical kind of goofy thing when it comes down to it. And the meat behind that is there's a massive Air Force drawdown at the time. For the first time in history, people that went to pilot training and passed, just to give you an idea, 35 people came into my pilot training class. And if I remember right, it was only 18 or 19 people that made it through the year. So, I mean, there's a pretty good cut right there.
50%.
Normally, those people would get out, and it's always plus or minus of that. I mean, mm-hmm. some have better classes or whatnot. But they're constant classes for this. But the thing is, right before we got our assignment, so we have to finish, and at the end, they figure out, hey, you're actually good enough to fly this, or you're okay, you go fly this. And there's a rack and stack process.
Okay.
And the fighters always went to the top guys in the class.
What were the credentials? Just grades?
Academics, grades, and flying performance. The consistency over time. It's a year long. I'm going to guess right now, it must have been 100 flights total over the year in those two aircraft. At the time, the wall came down, and the need, objectives, national objectives are affected because of the need for such a monster deterrent force, it kind of went poof because the wall came down.
What wall?
Berlin Wall.
When was that?
1987.
Okay, yeah.
I haven't thought in a while. I think it's 87. If not, it was 89.
It's right, late 80s. Yeah, right in there.
Yeah, so I'm going, 1990s when I graduated. And by that time, they went, wow, we can't support all this stuff. We need to put our money elsewhere. So we don't need to support as many fighter wings as we had. And I think we went from 35 to 18, 35 to 21.
So where are we I mean, as I'm listening to your story, I'm asking, where is Bud now? Is he in Germany? Is he somewhere? Where is he?
Del Rio, Texas, in the middle of nowhere with the best burritos. Anyway, so they had this drawdown. So not everybody who graduated got a cockpit. And I think out of the 18 of us got a cockpit, out of my class, collectively of the five bases, 100 or so people, there was only one fighter that I got, three other fighters that happened to be there. And, you know, the other 100 people got either tankers, transports, or they got put into what they called the bank, which was phenomenally heartbreaking. You know, you go to pilot training and you finish, the expectation is to go fly. Instead, they went to be whatever job needs to be done in the Air Force that had openings for 3 years, and then to come back after the drawdowns, hopefully, you know, kind of worked its way out. But this monster force structure thing really had an impact to the individual.
Okay.
What saved me? I studied, and probably the number one thing that put me over the edge over the number two, number three guy, who were all pretty close, was they saw that I helped people. I would routinely help people in trouble, which is a great lesson learned looking back. At the time, I didn't really put that together. But, you know, and people came to me afterwards to thank them. After pilot training, I couldn't have made it through without you, bud, you know, whatever. It's just the standard teamwork stuff I learned with John. We had some excellent teams in high school, which laid the foundation for my teamwork at the academy. I was a national champion in rugby. We had an excellent team. And it was all about the players. It was all about the team. I've always been a historical team guy. So when someone's down, you try to help them up. You try to teach them, not knowing I was teaching, but I was like, hey, this is what I do.
Right.
The foundation of teaching. This is what I do, and this works for me. Try that. And after I've grown as an instructor, they gave me the opportunities to get in teaching positions. And looking back now, I absolutely believe that I got that first slot because I helped other people more than anybody else did.
All right. So how would you describe the culture of the United States Air Force? Basically, you know, what were people rewarded for, recognized for, punished for? How would you feel like you had a good day? What did you have to go through to make a decision? You know, were you allowed to make a decision? The culture, as far as what you recall in the Air Force.
Here's something that you wouldn't know. Most people wouldn't know. Just like the smell, taste, and feel of getting an airplane ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard to describe. The uniqueness of if we just look at the fighter pilot business, because the fighter pilot business for officers, I'm hanging around a bunch of other fighter pilots.
Okay.
So the culture is almost separate from the Air Force. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying, you know, to frame it, I was shoulder to shoulder on a great football team in the Air Force. How's that?
Okay.
Everybody went through the same historical background for the most part. You had to be educated. You can be an officer without being educated. You asked about discipline in pilot training. That wasn't an issue. I mean, if you're acting like a kid in pilot training, you really kind of get your priorities wrong. We didn't see that. There was nothing overall bad in our groups we called squadrons. So a squadron is typically organized by, you know, 20 to 25 airplanes-ish, give or take. You had somewhere between 35 and 40 pilots and same amount of wizzos. And we kind of organized that way, take care of ourselves, and we try to learn and make ourselves better as a team to go do our thing. And what makes it unique is that we're all officers with a few enlisted in support roles within the squadron. Heavily biased towards the guys doing the same thing over and over again. Whereas everybody that's working to help us get that to that point of going to fight are all over the base in different capacities that we didn't touch normally. Like, I would shake the hand of my crew chief out there. I loved the crew chiefs because I knew they were taking care of me. But I didn't get to shake the hand of the person that may have been that did the sheet metal for a bird strike, because I'll never see him. I very rarely see him. As a standard fighter pilot, there are other roles that come later, but as a fighter pilot, you appreciate everybody that's out there helping you get there, but you don't get to touch them. Whereas in the Army, if you're an officer, second lieutenant, you could easily own 12 to 35 people in the squad or platoon. Different culture altogether.
You know, interestingly, you know, one of the things I did read and as I was trying to prepare for the opportunity to talk with you is that subcultures is something that it is something rather unique to this branch of the service.
Yeah, I mean it's a big enough organization where, and there is a specialty. We have to fly these airplanes. I mean, that's our purpose in life, is to deliver combat air power anywhere. I mean, I'm an air power advocate. I've also had the opportunity to grow and had to plan for things that affect everything. I mean, it's just the way it is. For people who get involved and stay long enough and progress at a clip that's respectable, I was very fortunate. The fighter business, I had a knack for it. You know, I studied as hard as everybody else, you know, whatever. But whatever the gifts that were given to me put me ahead of my peers for a good portion of the time. And it's not like I'm better than you kind of thing. It was just I kept learning. I kept being the guy. You get to be the guy too much, and you just keep on going to be the guy until I got exposed to a whole bunch of things. Actually, an easy example is the planning I had during the second Gulf War. I was involved in places I never expected to be. I never expect, by the way, I came from not exactly a beautiful place. You know, my parents came over on the boat. They struggled. They worked hard. They came over from Russia and Poland, actually. You know, Okay. Actually, my mom was popped out in the Ukraine during the war.
So you're a second generation, pretty much. I mean, your parents were not born here and moved here, and then you were actually born here.
I was.
Okay.
I was.
Huh. I didn't know that. That's amazing. So, Hannah, do you have something that...
Yeah, I wanted to speak a little more to the culture as a military brat, because, like, I grew up walking, running with my twin brother. Like, I always had someone by my side through this all, but we would be running around the halls of the squadron and, you know, playing on the whiteboards, which to me now says that it was a highly collaborative, team-driven culture, which, you know, work-play separation, I imagine there were some blurred lines there too, because, you know, Dad worked a lot. Dad worked long hours. It was you have to show up and, you know, deliver. It's the military, I can imagine, like, what sort of things he had to pull off, but at the same time, like, these are your people. You also unwind with those people too, because, you know, you're around them all the time. You get to know them, and those become your people. We had, I remember making dip for poker nights at our house. Like, often we would kind of host people in our home. Like, that's, I think that really says something about the kind of people that Dad got to work with.
Did you notice any changes as far as how the culture went, as things were being downsized and changed through the process?
Yeah, I would think it's almost like saying the American culture is this. I mean, it's too big. There's too
Got
many
you.
Facets, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, if you take bits and pieces of it from the leadership standpoint, I mean, from the top guy all on down, they all have their roles and responsibilities. But when it comes down to developing a culture in a small to medium-sized, even large groups, let's say a base. A typical base has 5,000 people in it. If the boss is walking around getting down on people, his leadership style is that of fear, the culture is gonna get buried. I mean, no one's going to want to work there. There have been cases over the last few years, I've noticed this guy got canned for this. This guy got fired because his boss lost faith in his ability to lead. However, you get a good man in there between his point where he started to 20 years in. It's about when you get to be a base commander. You get that guy who has learned and is just a good guy, a good girl who gets in there. Someone that worked for me became a base commander after I retired. I was like, not too bad, cool. But she was solid. She was very solid all the way through. Not because she was an average fighter pilot, above average pilot, or whatever, but her leadership developed a culture which now is divorced from the fighter business.
Okay.
She has to understand how the fighter business works, and she doesn't fly fighters every day, but she runs the community of the base. Now you get down to the chunk of the squadron level. Now you're now basically between the guys that fly in that group and the guys, the maintainers, big picture, that's really what makes them fly. If the leadership there is solid, then you're going to find the people are taken care of and the people's families are taken care of. If your family is not working right, you can't live at the pace that I lived at. It's impossible. We need more good guys. You know, look at the culture we have going on right now. You got a whole bunch of noise going on with people doing a power grab with a little fire. You know, I think the people in leadership positions are very passive and not stepping up and going, all right, we have some problems to take care of it. Here's a way forward, but the behavior's got to be good. We didn't have behavioral problems necessarily in the people I touched. There was onesie twosies. There's, you know,
sure.
You know, you're going to have some people that lose their way.
Yeah, foul ball.
It's just people that might not get it and leave, whether for ability or for attitude. Being a real person, you know, and it's not exactly in my mind. You will do this or that's it. It's not like that. I think leadership is different. There's management and there's leadership. And if you haven't learned to the point where you're in a leadership position and you don't learn leadership skills along the way, whether it be high school football, high school rugby, or leading men into combat, if you haven't learned along the way, you're going to be found out. A couple bad guys sneak in there and then they get removed. But in our community, the truth is so important. Actually, that's one of my benchmarks. The truth is absolutely, in my mind, the way I frame things now after being out of the Air Force, if you can't accept the truth, things go south. And I'll give you an example. When you think you go out, so now I'm this big bad Bud. Bud has a foreship. We're going to go out and blow things up. And, you know, in Vegas is a highlight of mine. A huge range, a lot of targets. You know, you just can't drop bombs over North Carolina, really. There is a place, but it's a small place.
Don't tell me something that I have to pretend like I forget.
It's all legal.
You can only fly solo.
Yeah. Right. There's only so much you can do out here. But over there, we have this magical space. It's our fighter pilot mecca.
Okay.
Huge chunk of airspace and land and stuff. It's, you know, about where they used to blow up the atomic bombs.
Okay.
We own half of Nevada. And we go out there and it would be killer. You can go up and think you have the perfect mission with your foreship and go out there and blow everybody up out of the sky, and you drop your bombs and hit your target. And you can come back, and right now we have so much information in the cockpits that are recorded, whether it be voice communication, you know, the screens that you see, they're all digital now, telemetry from the ground stations and what have you. We could now reconstruct what happened and find truth data. So even though you go out there and you think you shot everybody, you didn't know you got shot first. So you know, you do not ever make assessment until you get the truth data and then decide on how you're going to teach your guys how to do better next time.
Now, you're speaking in this. Now we're in exercises. So I'm gonna run a couple of things by you. So in martial arts, I'm a firm believer that a really good martial arts practitioner is well-versed in different objectives, okay? Typically, I'll put up things like, for example, we're going to practice self-protection today. And self-protection being, for example, me trying to escape a certain situation. Another version of self-protection may be the fact that I'm going down and I see somebody harassing Hannah. And as a martial arts practitioner, do I have enough courage and skill set to inject myself into this situation so that she's protected? So when you're out in Nevada or any other places, give us some examples of mission plans or objectives that you might be saddled with, you know, whether it's that's protecting something or escorting something or attacking something. You know, what type of things would you have normally been involved in?
Well, I think the best way to describe that is there's no great way to describe it. There really isn't. generic missions. If you go to, you could probably look up some doctrine for Air Force and Army that will define specific roles for air power. Now, we kind of broke that down a little further, and I would say generically there's terms like air superiority.
Hmm.
So the F-15 A and C, see now, that we talked about, their whole mission was to get air superiority.
I'm assuming by when you say that, that means like anybody who's in this airspace will succumb to us, or surrender or go away.
Well, we can't do that in the airplanes. What's funny about airplanes is you can't be in an airplane, hit park, and put your hands up. It doesn't work that way.
Okay.
You either go away or you mix it up. You know, if you're going to go two airplanes looking at each other from whoever knows, I mean, miles and miles away, and you decide to mix it up, there is a reason for that. Like I flew, there's this one flight I had in Estonia. You know where Estonia is?
I'm sitting here going, no, I have no idea. What country are we in?
Estonia. Estonia is a country on the Baltic Sea.
Okay.
I didn't mean to set you up on that. To be honest, I knew Estonia when I was asked to do this. It was neat. It was something to do with NATO. I was living in the United Kingdom at the time and flying out of there. And this thing happened in Estonia, and we were asked to go support them with air power with our jets. So we went up there and flew very close to the Russian border. The Russians decided to throw some airplanes up and go, kind of a show of power, this is our airspace mm-hmm. thing. And we're pretty close, and I'm going, you know, I don't want to mix it up. It would be absolutely an error in judgment for me to cross the Russian airspace. That's a huge international incident.
Right? Right.
And if I had real missiles and bombs and decided to go up there, and because it was all... everything but actually dropping a real bomb is what we did with these Estonians. But they're right there. I mean, they're right there. We know we're all looking at each other, and we're just kind of like, you know, two guys across the block, kind of...
okay.
You know, and I'm just trying to do my business going, stay over there. But those rules, international rules, I mean, this is big picture stuff that we just can't mix it up. If we were... in conflict with someone, such as the first Iraq war, where they actually put up airplanes to defend the country, that's when they mix it up. Our rules are very clean and very legal to have the ability to mix it up. And I'm doing the quote thing because clearly I'm dumbing it down. When we went, Nevada's the best case because I could picture this airspace, and it's the most advanced flying we have. Like, you know, Shaw's here, Seymour Johnson. We don't really have the airspace, the things to drop on, whatever. So Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas is is our haven. So when we have to drop real bombs, that's the place to do it. You know, there are other places, but that is the place. And it's been built like that for years and years and years. So to develop missions for our aircraft, what are we doing day to day? Well, I used to teach in the weapons school, and I almost promised, there's no way around it. The Top Gun you saw, the movie Top Gun, I could cut that one to pieces just like all the other fighter pilots have. And it's, you know, it's made for Hollywood, but there are a couple bits in there that are kind of powerful. Like when Cruise is getting yelled at by Goose, you know, Maverick Goose, I'm Bud.
Mm-hmm.
Maverick's sitting there, he's getting kind of, you know, hey, dude, you're messing up. And Maverick is sitting there doing what? He's studying. Studying was powerful, but no one ever catches that in the movie. Hmm. You know, they could, to make that movie accurate, they'd probably have to put a whole bunch more of that in there. The weapons school. The weapons school Top Gun is typically, or used to be, you know, 6 or 7 weeks to generate some kind of whatever objectives they have for that school. We had the weapons school, which was the doctorate level of fighter aviation, which has grown from its initial mission. But our syllabus for my airplane, all different airplanes are there, and we all go through the school together, and the school is twice a year, and it lasts five and a half months, which is just a powerhouse of nothing but studying and flying and getting pushed to, I can't say it, yeah I can, okay, pushed to the limit.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, you get pushed to absolutely do things you never thought you can do, to the point where you get finished with the school, you go back, they did what Cruise did, right? In the movie, they bring you in from the fleet, and then they puke you back out to the fleet.
Okay.
We do the same thing. We get the most qualified dudes to be, and it's an instructor course. So we would go through the instructor course to be a better instructor. I've never heard of any other place that teaches how to teach in such a dynamic environment and come out with the gifts that they give you. You go back to the squadrons. So I go back to the squadron, and I'm not the only one that said this, but you look around and you start following these guys, and you sit down and you go, did you guys, I just left for 6 months. How did you guys get so stupid? That's how much you learn at this place, and you forget where you came from. That course is built off of a stepping stone thing from the basics to the most complex that you can think of. Just like your white belt comes in and learns basically the basics, and they get to progress, they have to learn X. I don't know. She did for a little bit, but I'm not smart with the martial arts, but I respect what they do, and it's really neat how they develop character. This is kind of a different way to build character, and you step from flying one sortie with a single ship to see what the jet could actually do if you push this that we never do out there, and we make the thing dance a little bit better. The next block of instruction is called BFM, Basic Fighter Maneuvers. So you go out 1v1 and you mix it up. And you mix it up from a position of advantage, from a position of disadvantage. And you have to know, you teach these guys, the students, your best on how this fighter thing works. How you will fight me today. Your objectives are to kill me. If unable, and this is off of memory. Boy, it just came out of my head. Kill the bandit. If unable, maintain a position of advantage. And if unable, separate before becoming defensive. Those were our objectives, because our mission, the vision of the school, was to teach the best fighter instructors, to teach our best. The core of information and knowledge is coming to this thing, and when we spit you out, you want to get more instruction out to the fleet.
Okay, so let me see if I can rehash this for the audience. Pretty much the objective overall is air superiority, and then as you're practicing, you might have an exercise of trying to get air superiority and you already have the advantage. You might be trying to get air superiority and then you're from a position of disadvantage. And if I heard you right, you had three main objectives. Either kill the bandit. If you can't do that, maintain advantage over the bandit. And if you can't do that, get out.
That, I didn't do a good job at it. We started with overarching missions. Right? The purpose of the airplanes is to what? For the F-15C at the time, they had one mission. Gain and maintain air superiority. That's a big block. That's a big job.
Yeah.
So other aircraft can't hit our aircraft, or they can't hit our cities. We never think about airplanes bombing our cities. It can happen. Mm. We're just lucky to be a little island nation, to be honest. This is a theory. But effectively, we're an island nation. They have a long way to go to drop bombs on us, and Mexico isn't going to do it. Canada's our buddy, and okay, be pretty creative to get air power on us
across all that sea and before everything be picked up. Okay,
so that's a big block. Another one would be interdiction. Another air power mission would be interdiction, where we send jets to blow up things so they can't transport the logistical thing. So an airplane that we replaced is an F-111. We used to do deep strike interdiction because it had long legs and its mission was to drop bombs. It had a couple missiles for self-defense, but it didn't go blow up other airplanes. So it was a separate mission. Another easy mission is the suppression of enemy air defenses. They develop aircraft to go out there because now they got these little fancy missiles with all these, we call them beeps and squeaks, but radars that can be targeted that support the missiles that are trying to shoot us down. So it's a game of chicken with,
right.
That is a mission type.
Okay. Beeps and squeaks, is that what you called it?
Oh, beeps and squeaks are a fancy way.
You're right, I can hear it. Yeah,
we can go through radar theory.
But no, that's okay. We'll have to pick up on that one another time.
Thank you.
So, Hannah, any thoughts so far?
I want to hear about your briefing process. Because we were talking about how like martial arts in performance is more like of an individual thing, but you're always working with teams with the work that you were doing. So like, I guess, communicate, what's your process of communicating what you're actually doing today, and then how do you wrap it up at the end so it's a productive learning experience for everyone that was going through that exercise?
Yeah, here's another unique thing about the culture, our culture. There is nothing but benefit to making everybody else better. We have to make, I mean, we're not there to put anybody down. If you put someone down for the fact of putting someone down, oh, look, you screwed this up, you know, you didn't fly this properly or whatever, you stink and all that, that doesn't do anything for anybody. You know, you see that in society, people putting people down just for the to make noise. As any other team, you have to try to get everybody else better. So the only reason to fly is to get everybody better, to maintain proficiency, to learn something every time.
They made an entire new model airplane so it could have a two-seater just to teach out of from A to B, right?
They did. Well, I mean, there's reasons for that. The A-10, very, very cool airplane, one of my favorites. They only have single-seat things. They didn't even bother making, because it's so slow and it's such an easy transition to fly, they just went, why bother? Either you crash or you don't. No one crashes on their first flight, but, you know, there you go. For us to make everybody else better is very important. That's where it comes to the whole truth data. If we go out to fly to make the squadron better, we'll typically fly in bulks of the same kind of mission type. So this week we'll emphasize this, basically, the one versus one thing. We might have a week of one versus one for the week. Everybody has the same objectives, the same three I outlined. So I'm going to try to teach you how to be a better offensive fighter pilot today. As a crew, actually, as a crew, you two will practice your offensive. And by the way, I'm going to try to be the best defender I can be. So you can't shoot me, because my objective is now in direct conflict with my buddy in the room that I'm briefing.
He's your uke.
You're going to try to kill me. Yeah. I'm going to teach you as an instructor, and not just a flight lead. The flight lead will go in and say, this is what we're going to do today, and we're going to practice. An instructor will, and his role is to teach him how to do whatever he does better. So I'm going to teach you how to be the best offensive guy. This is what you can expect out of me. And we'll switch things up. We had three exercises. One would be him at an offensive position from a mile and a half back, one from a mile, and one from a half mile. Very different.
So this, as he's moving his hands, audience, it looks like a shark behind prey.
Fighter pilots point each other's hands. We shoot each other's hands routinely.
Okay, right. We need a good picture of that. All right. Yeah. So whatever. Okay, yeah. All right, got you.
You know, I might have one.
If my boys, if my old, my friends and my compatriots see me doing this, they're like, it took you a long time, but here you are doing it on the side, and I'm like, yeah, all right. But we do, to give visual things, we also had sticks.
Okay.
Sticks with airplanes on the end of it. We're visual learners.
Okay.
It is a visual dynamic environment that we fly in, and that's what we do. But those different exercises, I teach him what to expect out of the bandit. It's aerodynamically equal. We're the same airplane. We call it like versus like. So we know how our airplane maneuvers. Who's going to maneuver better to achieve the desired outcome? Because they're the same and because of the ranges, I know after years of doing this, this is the logical end state of each one of these engagements. If we fly equal, if he flies a little better or I fly sloppy, we're going to have different outcomes. And once I teach him how to do the best way of flying in each of those exercises, this is talking about 15 minutes of admin and about 45 minutes of this is how you do it. And by the time he's done, he's like, all right, let's go. And it's not a thumping chest. Oh, I'm really fired up to go fly. You need a little bit of that, but you got to fly smart,
right,
and apply what was in the briefing. And Bud told you, just like the other guys taught me. I was the same guy. I go, okay. And, you know, try my best. That bit of instructions are based off of objectives of that day. That's all they got to do. They don't have to go blow something up. They have to learn how to take this mission element and do my best to do it. And when we come back, we have tapes and tools to reorchestrate whiteboards, given the tape on what happened. So the guy that's learning goes, oh, I get what you're saying now. And if what I taught him wasn't correct, I'll try to give him a different technique on how to do it. I might give him multiple techniques how to do this one little element.
So we're at this point, Hannah, would you agree at this point, this is where you would be describing the debriefing component of it, right?
Right.
After the actions, now you're coming back together and saying, okay, you could have had me here, or things along those lines kind of things? Or
It's exactly that. I mean, typically we'd go out, we'd do an exercise or two to give a different picture for some kind of something.
Okay.
You know, here I am playing with my hands again.
So for you're playing with your hands again. So I'm gonna pose as you're moving your hands all through the air there. How fast are we going through some of these exercises? Give me some numbers.
We're talking about somewhere between 400 and 500 miles an hour when we start these exercises. And
okay.
The more you fight, the slower you get because you bleed in energy. It's a whole power thing.
I'm assuming that during these exercises, there's parameters set saying, okay, we're going to keep our flight speeds between 350 and 500. You know, the deck is here. The peak is here. This is your ring to play in, right? I mean, you know, as you described, we got airspace, but then those things are laid out in the briefing. Is that correct or is it not? Is that just something that they did in Top Gun? And
that's all academic stuff. And one of the things, it's like there's a, like off the coast of Carolina, it's a huge swath of airspace over the water that we use for different purposes.
Okay.
I mean, 100 miles by 100 miles, let's say generically. And we chunk those up in the airspace so multiple flights can go in there. And this is your chunk of the airspace. So if I came out with my formation, this room is where we're going to fight in.
Okay.
And it's up to me and the flight lead to keep us all in there as a flight lead, to keep us in there and execute whatever we're going to try to train to, what practice we have.
Okay.
So we'll do a couple exercises first. Maybe routinely we'll pull some G's to make sure that we don't go unconscious, because some days you're not feeling well. You pull G's, you lose consciousness.
Okay.
The blood goes out of your head and you're done. That's bad, and it's happened to many a pilot.
Mm.
So we practice with that. And then we get into the meat of the mission, which is the whole, in this case, basic fighter maneuvers. You shoot me, I'll try to live.
So my mind, what you were just talking about is that we were over the coast of somewhere off of the Carolinas, is that this is like when I'm in the dojo, the airspace, and I want to break up and have some of the advanced students work with some of the intermediate students. And you got this part of the dojo to work on your entries and get him subdued somehow. And the head instructor, or the one who's in charge of that area there, is going to make sure that everybody stays in their little area so that, you know, I don't give you a hip toss and throw you over into some other guy and other teammates that are practicing in another part of the airspace or the dojo, so to speak.
That's exactly it. The airspace is divided up. We sign up for it. It's like signing up. When we do the scheduling, we sign it up. We send the fax it over and say, okay, you got this airspace for this time. It's like signing up for a racquetball court.
I think the other things that, as far as the martial arts go, that made me kind of think about how you all work with each other. You know, when we get into some cultures and we'll bump into some folks occasionally, like I'll go to a seminar, and this happened a couple of years ago where we went to a seminar and one of my students was training with someone he had never met before, right? And occasionally you'll bump into some folks who, let's just say, have more interest in making sure that they're confident they did things right than necessarily the care of the person who they're in charge of. Now, based on what you're saying, that may not necessarily happen in the Air Force so much, because the culture is not to put someone down and is to get everybody, you know, teamed up. But I'm sure somewhere along the lines that you might bump into some, nobody likes to lose. And I'm assuming a fighter pilot, in all cases, what do you do as an instructor? Just put that to the side before you go up?
No, I mean, there's personality conflicts like anywhere. It's just not as prevalent. Everybody wants to do better, you're right. But the guy that, if I heard you right, the guy that tries to make himself look better than he is, in that environment, you will be called out. You can't get away with it.
Okay.
The power, a national power, you know, what you see in the on the airwaves today, the power of information, one of the pillars of power. You can't fake it. There's no fake news in this world. Once you get the brief and debrief, there's no way to twist it to say that I lived when I got shot. You know, I mean, right. It's like I did things to lead up to this, and you have to own up. If you don't own up to your mistakes, then you lose all credibility. And that it is almost neon when it happens. So you really can't get away with that with everybody as smart as they are. They might not be the best fighter pilot, but they're trying. They're studying. They see things. They'll get, there's no groupthink. There's a groupthink and the best way of going forward as a, this is how we're going to do better. Maybe. This is the best way, the best practice in businesses. You know, I'm going to copy this best practice. We kind of do that. And then we kind of always try to find better ways to do things. But if there's a guy that clearly says something that is untrue, there's no room for that. And, and there's no other way to put that.
Okay.
With all the information in such a dynamic environment. When I first started, I tell you what, you when you fly, when you're a brand new guy, and I'm the one being taught, and I'm listening to this guy that has, you know, 1,500 hours, explain to me how I'm going to shoot him. You sit there, and you might get 20% of the information and apply it. You might listen to the whole thing, but you're going, okay. You know, I mean, like a dog. Okay.
Yeah.
And then you go out there, and boom, the airplane starts. The canopy comes down. You're sweating. You goofed up something. You missed a radio call. You're all, oh, my God, he's going to kill me in the debrief. You're not even thinking about the big picture stuff when you're dorking up the admin. And this is the way it is.
Right.
The young guy just tries to hang on. We take off together. We go over there and do some exercises. You goof that up too. And you can't even get the airspeed right and the altitude right. And this guy's like going, oh, no problem. You know?
Yeah, right.
And then he calls fights on. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to go beat him up now. And then he starts moving. You're like, oh, I got to do something. That's the way it is. I mean, you're so not there yet. And the more you do it, and the repetition, it helps you out. But when you come to the debrief, and you see this stuff now on tape, and how dumb you look, you're like, I don't want to be dumb anymore. The comparison of a young kid maybe playing, you know, peewee ball, getting told by Brett Favre how to play quarterback.
Right. Okay.
There's only so much the kid could retain. You know? But over time, you know, you kind of build up, and that's gross exaggeration, but
I got you.
But how you focus that kid, that young bud that's sitting there going, okay, is you have clear objectives and you try to tell him as simply and as accurately and concisely as you can to pass the information to make him a better individual, a better pilot, a better teammate, because we're going to need you to do bigger and better things later.
I have a question. During your time, did anything really in your mind happen? And it could have been something that seemed sort of subtle at the time it happened, but as the years went by, you could reflect on it and say, you know, that changed me.
Yeah, I got a good one. I got a nice little one. Anybody who is like Flan Man in this story is a tribute to whoever that person is. Doing the right thing just for the right thing's sake. After I learned how to fly this jet, what happens is you learn, it was in Phoenix, outside of Phoenix, and then they moved me to North Carolina here at Seymour Johnson. And they plop you in they assign you to a operational squadron. It's called an operational squadron. So here I was in my first squadron, the youngest guy, and they haven't seen a young guy in a long time. And these guys just got back from the first Desert Storm. You just brought the jets back. Everybody's been there but me. You know, and a couple others that plopped in. It was another pilot that was a little older. But I'm just a new lieutenant pilot. I was the only lieutenant pilot. And I was the low man on the totem pole, big time. And I accepted as a role. I was ready for it. I got picked on a lot. I got teased a lot. And I've done a lot of good things. And here I am, a little peon, 23-year-old kid, and they checked me out. So you finish this program, and then they check you out in the squadron to make sure they didn't make any mistakes. So you actually have to go through a checkup program and go, okay, now you can go to war. Finally, after you know, your pilot training, all the other stuff. It was basically 2.5 years before they said, you can go to war. And they did it like 3 weeks before we went over to back to Saudi Arabia to do the Operation Southern Watch stuff. So I'm going to a different country. This is BATS in my head. In my head, we're going over there. This is BATS. Everything smells different, tastes different, and I have to go over bad guy land. So I'm still the guy going, okay, and they're going to take me over bad guy land. And they pair me with this instructor pair and a relatively new weapon systems officer in my backseat. We kind of fly together mostly for the first couple weeks, and they are the example that I have, the instructor crew, flying as a two-ship from the middle of Saudi Arabia over Iraq to do our business and come back. This instructor crew doesn't like Bud, and they think they are the worst kind of instructors. They are the instructors that want to make them look good, you know?
Okay.
They have, one has a personality conflict with everybody, you know? And they weren't teaching me. They weren't teaching me at all. One day we went up in a four-ship, and this guy is getting on me because I'm on the tanker, and I have a hard time with it. No one's really taught me how to get on the tanker. These guys have done it 100 times each.
Okay, so pause on a tanker. Are we talking about a big ship?
You got this big orca-looking aircraft that has a lot of gas in it with a thing sticking out the back.
Oh, gotcha, okay.
That I have to stick in my airplane.
Gotcha, okay, yeah, all right.
You know, at the time, it was like, who invented this dumb idea?
You know? I'm refueling in the midair through a hose pipe.
You know, you're flying formation. I've got used to this fighter formation thing. I'm all good with that. Now I got to be next to this orca thing and have him stick me, don't move, while he sticks me to get this gas. The first time I did it was in training in Arizona. It was at night and there's thunderstorms all over the place. Scared the bejesus out of me. I mean, sure. It just really made a mental block on me doing this event.
Okay.
Which thousands of people have done. Oh, our guys. Thousands of times. And I'm sitting here, that's what you have to do when you're over there because it's so far of a distance to tank up and sure you have gas and do whatever you got to do. And this guy's just on me. And I'm like, oh my God, this is going bananas. And anyway, I come back and a non-flight lead or brand new flight lead, it takes time to do that. I'm just a wingman. I will follow everybody else. This brand new flight lead said, I am sick of this guy talking about you. This is how I tank. And he drew pictures on the whiteboard. He pulled me into this brief room, put this whiteboard up, started talking about pictures and pulled out some things and said, this is what I do. And I put my seat all the way down. The things you never think about, or this guy would never teach me. Hmm. He just said, how come you're messing up? The instructor was more of an evaluator. Oh, you stink. You know, you're not doing that right. But he didn't teach me how to fix it.
Okay.
That was one of the firmest and greatest stories for me on instruction. It took a guy just to tell me what he does to give me a technique that I could go up there and nail. Okay. And I did. I used exactly what he did, and I had to fumble a little bit at first, but I was like,
you had a path.
I got it now.
Okay.
You know, I mean, for the older guys that, you know, don't think back to that first time they had to tank or refuel airborne, it's the dumbest thing in the world. I mean, it's just... It could be a stressful thing.
Mm. Some of the simplest techniques in martial arts are sometimes the hardest to get.
I think that's why, I've totally heard this 100 times, but I'm a huge fan of the basics. When things get all messed up, not only, you know, do you try to, not only is it best to stop and pause for a little bit, you know, take care of yourself first. Now let's assess what's going on and take the proper action. That kind of mantra works pretty well.
Mm.
But not only fall back on basics for complex things, but the habits that we've developed. Mm. I think, and I was guessing, when you're... One, I never want to get into a fight with you because I'm not so tough without my jet. You scare me. But to be honest... If you fall back on habitual patterns that we do, we try to, it's not drilling, but it's doing the same thing over and over again and modifying the instructor's, the role of the instructor, if you happen to have one, is to kind of tweak it to make it just a little bit better. And if you're having a problem, to offer different techniques.
Hmm.
The instructor if you get something, if you're a good fighter pilot and you know how to do something, one event, one task of the 1,000 you have to do every time you fly, whether it be keeping your timing to hit a certain point or to, I mean, timing is a big thing. There's a whole bunch that goes into it. Into flying jets. Any one task could have multiple techniques. Your job as an instructor is to, if he's having a problem, identify the problem and to offer a different technique, or he's never thought about this, to achieve, it could be as simple as achieving to free brain bites for your mind to go somewhere else or focus on something else.
Okay.
When I went to the weapons school and taught there, not only did I go there as a student, they asked me back to teach, just like, you know, whatever.
So the Top Gun, you went back to teach.
Weapons school. So I went back to teach and learned even more about teaching because you couldn't screw up against the best guys coming in. You say something wrong, you're going to get caught up like that. And like, it was harder than being a student almost.
Right.
But the job of me over there is not only to have three techniques for one particular task, I learned a whole bunch more. So I had like 9 of them.
Okay.
Actually, I had 8, and I was always open to hear the 9th because these guys are smart. They might have come up with something to actually kind of make, I was like, never heard that one. Let me try it. But by that time, it's kind of rare, but you're always open to listen to that for that 9th.
Right.
Another, that's a theory of mine. I think that's an important part of.
I love that though, because the idea of mechanically saying, okay, look, we have a task, and we're going to try to have 2 or 3 techniques to accomplish what I call the ends. These are the means to accomplish these ends. And then when you get along with some of the other folks who are pretty good in some other areas and different things, and you pick up some other stuff too, you're not really sure what they're going to do. You know, they're not a F-15 fighter pilot. They're used to following this. So some of their techniques and approaches are just slightly different than what you're used to seeing.
We call them different toys.
Okay.
Other airplanes might have different toys.
Okay. You end up having to respond in a fluid situation to the dynamics that are changing. Speak to that for a moment. How, when an athlete, or even in wrestling or martial arts and things like that, when you do something enough, things slow down, right? I mean, even though the speed on the timer is the same, in the actions and responses that occur, things tend to slow down. Does that happen when you're doing 500 miles an hour against other guys at that level?
Yeah, I think that's pretty neat. I, a whole different. Your things slow down. They don't necessarily slow down. I think you just process differently. A huge problem we have in aviation, not just fighter, just when you have. Like right now, I am task saturated. My brain is going full tilt trying to figure out how to get this to you properly. Things don't slow down. I think, in my opinion, you're able to prioritize where you get the information at the proper time to see more.
Mm.
When I was little bud, I was sitting there going, okay, rarely did you look outside of the heads-up display. There's this display right here that tells your airspeed and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you did your best to make sure your airplane was just flying properly.
Okay, right?
And
stay
and
between
like,
the lines.
Okay, and then you got to do that, and you got to fly off of this guy, and one of our standard formations is 2 miles apart, line abreast. So we fly in parallel.
Okay. 2 miles apart.
2 miles apart. So he's this little guy right over there.
Right. You know,
it's a 50 or a 60 some odd foot or length airplane. And it's this little semi-quasi dot over there. And he's very skinny. If he doesn't have his wing up. So
right.
You know, he's right there.
Where it profiles, basically, what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
So you're trying to fly properly at the right altitude, and you're flying off of that guy, and that's all you know.
Right.
Somehow I got from there to being a mission commander leading, you know, 80 airplanes against bad guys.
Hmm.
And to drop bombs and have an idea where everybody is, and listen to what's going on and take in what we call the battle space. So this is where things are going to happen, at least in this air fight, and I have to apply all this. I gave great directions in my planning. This is what we're going to do with these 80 airplanes for different mission types to get different roles to do this, that, and the other thing. And then it gets to the point where I'm like, all right, we got it. And we have this time where basically it's like fights on at a certain time, and we all mix it up.
Okay. Go ahead.
How I got from here.
Right. Little Bud staring up. There. Miss Daisy driving her car.
Yeah. There's a lot of stepping stones involved.
Right. And,
when does it become that you just have to let go of the plan, the reins a little bit, and just exercise trust that these guys are going to be doing what it is that they need to over in their zone while you're occupying your zone?
Well, there's only so much you can handle as a person, right? As a
yeah.
Does this work in the other room?
Oh, yeah.
I think there's only so much the human body could deal with. There are two things that really comes to mind. There's a concept, and I don't know if concept's the right word, but for air power, concept of properly applying air power is having centralized command and decentralized execution. If you have centralized control and centralized execution, you'll have the model that typical former Soviet Union aircraft and tactics, techniques, and procedures are, where the guy on the ground will make decisions for the pilot.
Hmm.
Instead of the pilot going, you told me to do this, I'm going to go do it the best way I know how. It is impossible to grab your hands on a gaggle without having the air sense of being out there. The whole drone thing, you know, it's a debatable point, but the real concept of the planning is so important for us to properly give guidance to the people who are going to go out there and do the mission.
Hmm.
Everything's based off of that. Now, you asked... So that big picture battle space thing, when I'm a mission commander, I was given a task on the tactical level. There's multiple levels of operations. The tactical levels where me as an airborne mission commander gets to make decisions on making sure this thing gets going. It was kind of up to me. I always had overhead to back me up on some of those decisions. But really, everybody's looking to me to come up with a plan to tackle this problem. And once we get airborne, I may make some big picture decisions. But when we say that fight's on thing, everybody knows their job. You know, we're going to go do our elements of all these airplanes at different altitudes to execute the mission.
Hmm.
So I don't have to know the whole battle space, but I have to listen to key things that might influence my decisions. But if I was Little Bud, I'd be sitting there going, oh my God, I don't know what's going on. Where's my flight lead? And that was out of all those 80. If I could just hang on to that guy,
right.
I might make it out of here without swapping paint with another aircraft.
Okay.
So, yeah, we could talk about that for a long time, but I'll knock it off there. The other thing you said is when do you say that there's too many contingencies? There's, and I think the answer that I came up with was there's a term that I learned in one of the schools, in one of the courses that really kind of stuck with me concept-wise, is the idea of culmination.
Culmination?
Culmination.
Okay.
So in a big fight, you know, in any conflict, there's a point where you are either unable to continue the attack or you're unable to properly defend.
Okay.
If you think about it, you got someone by the ropes, and he can't do anything else. That is his point of culmination on perhaps one of your engagements. Let's call it that way, where a guy is unable to defend anymore.
Okay.
And you can picture that pretty well. Can you picture that across? There's, you know, unless you see a white flag, it's really hard for, let's say, Germany. For Hitler to get in his head that there is no way we can defend anymore, because they kept on fighting. He kept on adding kids, and, you know, we're going to keep on going. Mm. After all the sequence of events, the generals knew, but they were afraid to say so. You know, in a big picture, it's not exactly true, but they knew they were done. They have culminated. They are unable to defend against the Allies in World War II.
Mm.
They have culminated. So that's a grand scale of the idea of how to apply that word. So... macro to micro, that word works pretty good. Now, what are you going to do? If you are culminated, if you have culminated in business, if you have culminated in a relationship, there might be a few reasons for that. And maybe there are different paths to achieve your vision. Mm. So we get away from objectives. My objective is to start this business, pet this dog, and marry this woman. Those are objectives for my vision of a happy life.
Mm.
Well, the woman tanked on me. You know, the dog bit me, and you know, this business got taken over before I could get my nose.
The good,
in there.
The bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, but my vision is still there. Right?
Okay, okay.
I still have my vision for a happy life, and that's where people should focus, and not necessarily go with the tactical level. Your strategic vision level is: I want a happy life. I want to give. I want to build a monastery so that I get to heaven. You know, that's a little...
I know what you mean. Weird, but, right.
The curveballs in life, the fog and friction of life, we call it fog and friction of war, the stuff that you didn't see coming and the stuff that's ruining or messing with your plan. That stuff is always going to be there. And you
fog and friction. That's a good one.
Well, added to your list of Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz. I think he's the one that first said fog and friction in his monstrosity of a book.
All right, Hannah, anything pop up?
Yeah, I don't mean to derail you, but this might be changing the subject.
Well, let's do it.
Okay. So in high school, your team didn't lose for, like, how long?
Well, we went undefeated, and then John left. My senior year, we lost the fifth game to Lakeland, 7-0. Drove me nuts, 7-3. And we lost the championship game. The idea of making teams better, the teamwork thing is, I think, my foundation. I learned that with John. I've had great teams.
He's great at it, by the way.
The guy he's always been a giver. Givers make good teams. My squadrons were full of givers. I have learned, I am not Bud. I am actually a compilation of a whole bunch of different people that gave me good stuff in my head, which also gave me the ability to sit in the pockets of generals. I sat face-to-face with generals, two-way conversations for extended periods of times because of the situations I got put in. And good men, absolute good men. I have learned that's who made Bud. Where it started was hanging out with John and listening to his name was Coach Keel. He passed away a few years ago. The love of community and service to the team and team being supportive, monster building block. And does everybody get that? No. I got it again when I went to the academy. And I got it again when I got into the fighter units.
Mm.
So I don't know any different. Right. I don't think there's anything other than service. And maybe that's the way I'm wired. But I think Coach Keel and the rest of them, I could name 100 in the row, that I think the United States needs more of right now. I think I've always thought that, but particularly now.
Now, Mark, anything else you want to make sure you add in there?
The only time I really feel like I have accomplished something, I think I did a good job, but when I see someone that respects me, that's all I needed was that.
That was all right.
Right face. You know? Right. And I could think of a few of them just going, man, this guy that looked like you was an old... A-10 fighter pilot. I did him, and just talking about the mission commander thing, I did that at my class at the weapons school, and we porked it. A graduation exercise. We're all out there.
Is that a good thing? Porked it.
No, we
okay.
Tubed it. We went inverted and pulled.
Okay.
We all I thought everything went great, and we came back in the debrief, we got the truth, and we... and. One by one, it was like a thing. The first guy messed up with the most important thing, and then everything else just fell. And it turned out to be like I was the only guy that left. Like me and two other guys were left alive at the end of this thing. Airplanes everywhere. And I sat around, and it was my mission. I was the mission commander. I planned it. Everything was great, and everybody messed their execution. I got up on stage in front of hundreds, and I had to debrief hundreds. And I sat there and went, wow, I got nothing to say except we're a pretty bad example. Mm. I mean, we're supposedly the best or graduation next. I mean, this is in a nutshell, but I just went, man, we just porked it. and I don't remember exactly the words, but when we're done, I'm like, all right, you're cleared off. Everybody got up and left. And the guy, his name was Coach. Oh, like you. Probably like plus a little bit. Oh, he came out and went, He gave me the grunt, shook my hand, and he left. I went, that's all I needed.
We're good to go.
I'm good. We porked it, but I debriefed it right.
That's awesome. So tell me now, we're going to kind of pole vault out. What are you doing now? Let's say that somebody would like to learn more from you or talk more to you about the Air Force or some of the other things you're doing. What are you doing now?
I'm looking forward to the next step. The fog and friction of life, you know, and contingencies. I have been playing poker full time. My last job, let's stop that and start again. I flew for a long time. When I retired, I had to come back and ran into, in the poker world, what we call is running bad. You know, family stuff happened, you know, multiple of things and contingencies happened until my father died. So the greatest thing about that, with all the time I spent away and what have you, when I left at 17, through my retirement at 41, rarely did I see my folks. You know, they were proud as anything. Bud's flying fighters. That's all good. But I didn't get to spend much time with them at all.
Right.
When my dad got, my mom finally called me up and was like, you know, Dad's sick. Why don't you move down here? And I did. So I went down. I spent a lot of time with him. And wouldn't give that up for the world. And once he passed, Saudi Arabia bought our aircraft. You said other countries have them?
Mm-hmm.
They have different versions of the aircraft we made. It's quite normal with firearm and military sales.
Mm-hmm.
They've been asking me to come teach at their weapons school for quite some time. And, you know, things happen for a reason. I think Dad got into someone's head and they upped their offer on me coming out to Saudi Arabia. And I got three job offers in the same day. The day I cleaned up things with him and my mom, and I thought she was going to be okay, and I went, maybe it's time for me to start working. The next day I got three job offers. This will be in one of them. And I took it.
Okay.
To Saudi Arabia. Went out there. Didn't enjoy it, but I got to fly again. Mm-hmm. And then when we parted ways, I came back to Florida, and I sat there and went, all right, now what? I got a place next near my semi near to my mom, and that's the reason I went to Florida. And I went, okay, what's next? My son dared me to play poker for a while, and he's like, dude, he just got back from Florida. You know, come on, enjoy it.
Hmm.
And I want to, and it stuck. And I wound up being a caravan kind of guy, going up and down the coast,
okay,
playing poker. That is over. I enjoyed it. I did it for a reason, and it's all good. Now I'm into doing what else I've been doing is helping individuals in small groups deal with their problems. I've become, with the things I've learned through all the tactical, strategic, and operational levels of war and planning, I have now brought to individuals in small groups and a little bit of teaching and a little bit of lectures. I've done that for in and out for a lot. And then it also became involved in personal problem solving.
Okay.
So people that have gotten to some kind of it is now, by word of mouth, brought me from anywhere from Colorado to Detroit to, you know, several places around the country for me to fly out and help someone through a problem. So basically I've seen myself as a mentor.
Okay.
And that's the way it's been going, and there I go. You know, I get a call, I go help this person out, and I've done that for a little bit, and I think I'm going to formalize it. It actually started before the COVID hit, fog and friction, didn't see that coming.
Right.
Friction messed with my plans. I started on the path of keynote speaking and leadership talks.
Okay.
That has been put on pause because of the number of groups, so now I'm going to transition to online and prepare myself for getting to the keynote speaking, what have you.
Okay.
And also starting a book. So how are you going to find me until things chill out by the end of the summer is by following my page on Facebook, which is Bud Speaks. Once I get everything formalized, I'm going to populate that, get the information out. And if you want me to come help you, I'm happy to do that. Want me to come speak for you, I'm happy to do that too.
All right. Well, thank y'all for having me. And I'll come back here again soon.
Oh, it'll be a pleasure.
Yeah.
Oh, that was good. I loved it.
I really hope you got a lot of value out of that. I know I did. How much of Mark's experiences could you connect with? Martial arts and as well as in your personal life.
It's not like I've never had a dog try to bite me before. The fog and friction of life. Scared to start something. Scared when it escalates the first few times to a place you're not quite sure how it's going to turn out. Learning to be responsible for yourself. Then being responsible for someone else. And for a few, a responsibility for a large group and the experiences that they have. Look at what you can implement into your practice scenarios, including today. Centralized command and decentralized execution. That's something we have a practice step for called the Three Leopards Practice that gives the students a taste of what that means. Give them some airspace, give them an objective and some rules, and get out of the way to allow them to execute. The fogs and friction of life. And does the school that you train in have the culture to make everyone else in there better? And it doesn't have the practice of putting them down. Mark has agreed to come back, where we're going to put some other topics in our sights. Leadership, for example. Go find him on Facebook, Mark Weiser, or look for his page, Bud Speaks. Let him know that you appreciate taking the time to share. This is T.W. Smith, the Kung Fu Podcast. I'll be talking with you soon.